Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Desperate Plan. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. The Song of Solomon, we have seen, is written in the form of a drama in five acts. And it's written like a play script, only without any of the notes on who is speaking or what is going on, what the stage directions are. So we have to gather what the story is from what is said, for just straight from the dialogue. And we've seen that what the story is that there is a love triangle between a country girl, her country boy shepherd lover to whom she is betrothed, and Solomon, who tries to steal her away from him. And last time we saw that Solomon, on the way home from his latest wedding, because of course he had tons of them, he had seen the country girl and fallen for her. And he took her into his train, like it or not, as he was heading back for Jerusalem. He arrived in Jerusalem to much admiration, although everyone praised everything in his cavalcade except his new bride. Nobody cared because Solomon already had so many of those. So a new queen wasn't even special anymore. Now, the girl is in Jerusalem, and her betrothed shepherd has risked himself to somehow sneak in and come to see her. And he was praising her, as we saw in Song of Solomon, chapter 4. And we're up to verse 9. The shepherd is speaking, and he says to her, "You have ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes, with one link of your necklace." So you've ravished my heart, he says, but the Hebrew more indicates that she has put heart into him. And the idea is that she has given him courage. And I think that's by her constancy. She could have said, I used to be betrothed to that little country boy shepherd back when I was just a country girl, but now I'm wanted by the king. Now I have a chance to be a queen. So forget that little boy I used to care about when I was just a common girl. Now I'm going to be a queen, so who cares about him? But no, she doesn't say that. She's constant. She loves her shepherd boy. She doesn't want the king. She wants her beloved shepherd. And her constancy puts courage into her shepherd boy beloved. Now he calls her my sister, my spouse. But remember, this is betrothed spouse, not married spouse. Remember, the betrothal ceremony was the legally binding ceremony. You were a betrothed husband and a betrothed wife, which is different from anything in our culture. I mean, we don't talk about engaged husbands or engaged wives. But betrothal was legally binding. So she was his spouse. It was just the problem was that somebody besides him could get a divorce as long as they weren't married. Her brothers could negate their vows, negate their marriage, so that she could marry Solomon as long as they were only betrothed and not married. Then he says, "You have ravished my heart with one look of your eyes." Well, the New King James added look there, but really what he says is with one of your eyes and with one link of your necklace. And why is this? Why just one of her eyes? Well, it's not that she's one-eyed. What this probably means is, remember back then, women, and in that part of the world, in that culture, women wore veils. But it seems that when they were speaking in conversation, what they would often do is move their veil halfway. So it was just covering half of their face, and half of their face was exposed. So that's apparently what she has done. She's moved her veil over halfway. So he can see one of her eyes because she's removed her veil from in front of it, and he can't see the other one because the veil's over there, and now it's doubled up in front of that eye. So he can't see that eye at all, but he can see one of her eyes. And he still sees her love for him. He sees her faithfulness to him in that eye, and that gives him courage. And that's also why he can only see one half of her necklace, that's all he can see because of her veil. Then he says, verse 10, "How fair is your love, my sister, my spouse? How much better than wine is your love, and the scent of your perfumes than all spices." So he says, her love, or her endearments, is the idea, are beautiful. His sister, his betrothed spouse. Then he says, her love is better than wine. Well, that reminds me of what she said of his love back in chapter 1. I noticed that these two lovers, they say the same things about each other. He says, her love is better than wine, and the scent of her perfumes than all spices. He'd rather smell her perfume than any other spice in the world, no matter how much more expensive it might be. Verse 11, "Your lips, O my spouse, drip as the honeycomb. Honey and milk are under your tongue, and the fragrance of your garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon." So he describes her, again using a lot of figures from nature. He describes her lips as dripping like a honeycomb, and honey and milk being under her tongue. Well, could this be a reference to kissing, do you think? Maybe? And then he mentions the fragrance of her garments is like the fragrance of Lebanon, that forest with the beautiful pungent-smelling wood. He says, "Your garments smell the same way." So he is praising her, but then in verse 12, he praises her a different way. He says, "A garden enclosed is my sister, my spouse. A spring shut up, a fountain sealed." So he describes her as a garden, a beautiful garden with many delightful things in it, but this garden is closed in. It's shut up so that no one can enter it. She is like a spring with much water, and yet the spring is shut up. She's like a fountain, and yet the fountain is sealed. What's he talking about? Well, he's talking about her chastity. She has many delights, but she has kept those. She has shut those up. She's not allowed anyone in to enjoy them. In other words, this girl has kept her virginity, and that makes her fruit precious. She hasn't shared it with just anyone. So he praises her for her chastity. Verse 13, "Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, fragrant henna with spikenard." So he speaks of her plants, she's like a garden, and he speaks of her plants like an orchard of pomegranates. Now, orchard in Hebrew is literally a paradise. An orchard is called a paradise. Now, remember that in the beginning we say that Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden. But was the Garden of Eden like a garden like you would have it in your yard? No, as we read the book of Genesis, the Garden of Eden was really an orchard. It was really the Orchard of Eden, not the Garden of Eden. And that Orchard of Eden was a paradise. So in the Hebrew, the word for orchard and for paradise is the same word. So he says she's an orchard, or he could say she's a paradise. Either way, she is a paradise of pomegranates with pleasant fruits, all kinds of pleasant fruit besides pomegranate, fragrant henna with spikenard, beautiful spices, beautiful smells. Verse 14, spikenard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with all trees of frankincense, myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices. So again, praising her, her beautiful garden that she shut up and preserved, is a garden full of spice plants and frankincense trees. And that's how he describes her. Verse 15, a fountain of gardens, a well of living waters, and streams from Lebanon. So in this garden is a fountain, and it seems that that was kind of a typical thing. A customary thing that they did at the time is that at the center of a garden, flower garden or an orchard or a spice garden, they would have at the center of that garden a fountain, a garden fountain. And all the gardens of the time tended to have one. And so he describes her as this beautiful shut-up garden, and in the center of the garden is the fountain, a garden fountain that is a well of living waters. Now, in the Bible, we recognize that living water, and remember, Jesus Christ talks about himself as the source of living water. We understand that living water is flowing water. Flowing water. Flowing water is living. If it's dead water, if it's just a stagnant pool, then it's dead. But if it's flowing water, it's living. So he describes her as a well of living waters and streams from Lebanon, from that beautiful forest of Lebanon. So this is the way he describes her. He describes her as being precious. And then she answers him in verse 16. "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south. Blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out. Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its pleasant fruits." Now here, she introduces a desperate plan. And this is the desperate plan that this couple decides to carry out. And that is that they must consummate their marriage this night. Now, as I've explained throughout this study, this couple was betrothed. And a betrothal was considered official. It was considered legally binding. And it actually required a divorce to break. And if you had relations with anyone else while you were betrothed, it was considered adultery, just like it would have been after you were married. Now, it was generally frowned upon for a betrothed couple to sleep together. You became betrothed, and then you went back home and you prepared for marriage. The woman learned about how to run a household. The man learned his trade, and then once both families said they were ready, then they would come together in marriage. So it was frowned for them to sleep together, but it wasn't considered downright sinful since they were legally bound. And it's hard to compare it into anything in our culture because our culture doesn't work this way. But the nearest I could compare it to is, I've said, that it would be like if a couple, after they had the wedding ceremony, but before the reception, later that evening, a couple hours in between, that they suddenly disappeared, ran off together to quick consummate their marriage before the reception. Now, tongues would wag about that. Heads would shake. You'd say, what? You know, what's wrong with this couple? They couldn't wait a few hours? They couldn't wait till that evening? What's wrong with them? You know, it'd be frowned upon. It'd be talked about. And at the same time, you'd have to admit, well, I mean, they had gone through the legal ceremony. They were husband and wife. You can't say there's anything downright sinful about it, but good grief. I mean, what's wrong with them that they couldn't wait till the evening? So it'd be considered kind of scandalous, but not sinful. Now remember that the pickle they're in is that they are betrothed, and while they're legally bound, a betrothal can be broken off by the man or the woman's family. And either family, that it's been a contract between the two families that these are going to get married, and either one of the families can break the contract and say, we want a divorce, we want to annul this marriage before it happens. Now 1 Corinthians 7, Paul talks about this, and translating 1 Corinthians 7 and trying to understand it in our culture has confused many people. Because Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 talks about betrothed husbands and wives, and their fathers deciding whether to marry his daughter to her betrothed husband or whether to not, whether to delay the marriage or whether to even cause the couple to get divorced. And it's all about the father deciding what to do with his betrothed daughter. And then we try to transfer this over to our culture where we have no such thing, and people get all confused about 1 Corinthians 7. And sometimes our translators get confused and they translate it wrong and think it's talking about divorce after marriage, and nobody really knows what's going on. But this was the thing, that while you were betrothed, before you were married, your family, it doesn't even have to be your decision, your family could break off the marriage. That your family could call for a divorce without you having even a say in it. Once you were married, however, things were different. Once you were married, the only person who could cause a divorce was the husband. Deuteronomy 24:1 tells us about this when it says, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. So once they are married, only the husband could call for a divorce. He could write a bill of divorce and give it to his wife. Now this was all about protecting the woman. Because understand at the time that a woman could not get work outside of her family business. If she was young, living with her parents, she would work for her father's business. If she was married, she would work for her husband's business. If her husband was dead, she'd work for her son's business. And if her husband was dead and she didn't have a son, or if she was divorced and couldn't go back to her father, well, she was in trouble. She'd be out on the street. So a woman who got divorced, almost even to live, to survive, she would have to find another husband. But the problem was, if she didn't have any legal documents saying that she was divorced, she could find another man, marry him, and then her old husband comes along and says, hey, wait a minute. I was married to this woman. She's with another man. She's an adulteress. And I demand that both she and her new husband be put to death as adulterers. And he could do that. Well, imagine what a pickle that woman would be in if she didn't have proof that she was divorced. No man would want to marry her. I mean, would you want to marry someone if you knew you could get executed for doing it? I think that would really cool off your passion really quick, wouldn't it? If you knew you could get killed for marrying someone. So it would be almost impossible for her to find another husband. So that was why he said to husbands, if you are going to divorce your wife, you have to give her legal papers so that she has a chance to find another husband, so she isn't out starving on the streets. So that was God's compassion working there. But while they were only betrothed, see, her family could call for a divorce. And remember, her father was dead, her brothers were in charge, and they don't seem to be very sympathetic to her and her betrothed husband. Well, remember, he had probably already paid the bride price. They'd probably already got, the family had already gotten the money they were going to get for this marriage. And now all that would happen is they would have to give her dowry when she got married. So the money that was going to come in had already come in, and all that was left was for money to go out. And so they weren't super eager for that marriage to happen. Now, even if they had to refund his family if they broke off the marriage, well, still, imagine the offer Solomon could make, the money he could pay them to marry their sister. Well, it seems that as long as she was in their hands, their relationship was doomed. But if they consummate their marriage this night, then suddenly it removes her brothers from the picture. Now only her shepherd can break the relationship. Now it seems that he is kind of hinting at this. Notice what he said about her chastity before. It's like he's saying, well, it's not that I don't value your chastity, but don't you think maybe we need to do something about this right now? And she is the one who actually brings it up and says, come into your garden. Yes, I've been a garden sealed up, but now you need to come into it. And I think that's because she realizes that's the only way they can foil Solomon's plot to steal her away from her betrothed. So he answers, Song of Solomon 5:1, I have come to my garden, my sister, my spouse. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb with my honey. I have drunk my wine with my milk. Eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. Well, what's going on here is I think he agrees to the plan. Now, it isn't that he has already done it, but I'm doing it. It's like he says, let's do it, my sister, my spouse. Let's consummate our relationship. Let me come into my garden. Let's do that. Now, normally, when you consummated your relationship as a betrothed couple is when both families agreed you were ready. And sometimes you'd have a second legal ceremony. You'd have a marriage ceremony to celebrate that. But the thing is that their families aren't there. And so it seems that what they do is they consult the only adults who are there, which are the court ladies and the courtiers who have been sympathetic to this young girl and agreed with her that Solomon, their master, shouldn't be allowed to steal her away from her betrothed. So they kind of turn to them and they agree to it. They say, eat, O friends, drink, yes, drink deeply, O beloved ones. So they agree, this is what you have to do. This is probably the only way that you are going to be able to continue your relationship and not have Solomon bring an end to it. So the only adults they can consult, they do consult, and they agree with it. So they try to do everything right as much as they can. And I think they are very commendable, absolutely commendable in everything they do here. But I also think this is very interesting because in this story, this shepherd boy, this young man, he risks himself to come into Solomon's very house and under Solomon's nose save his beloved from him by consummating his relationship with her. Now that was risky because Solomon was a king, an absolute ruler. And think what he could do to a rival. Think what he could do to a strange man he finds sneaking into his harem, where he keeps his women. And that's why kings often, I don't know if the Israelite kings would do it, I hope they wouldn't, but kings often would have eunuchs. They would make a man a eunuch in order to have him take care of his harem, because they didn't want him getting any ideas about his wives. Well, Solomon, if he catches the shepherd boy sneaking into where he keeps a woman he wants for himself, he could, at the very least, make the shepherd boy into a eunuch, if not put him to death altogether. So he is definitely risking himself to sneak into the enemy's camp to save his beloved by consummating a relationship with her. And in this, I think we see a beautiful picture of our beloved shepherd, the Lord Jesus Christ. Because he entered this world, which is the enemy's camp. Remember, Satan is the God, little g, God of this world. Satan said to Christ when he was tempting him that the governments of this world are his. He has control of them, and Christ didn't argue with him. So Christ, when he came into earth, he came into the enemy's camp. And he not only risked his life, he gave his life in order to consummate a relationship with us and to save us from a doom that we couldn't escape on our own. And when another, Satan, claimed us, Jesus Christ entered Satan's camp to redeem us for his own. Well, I think this shepherd boy is a beautiful picture of our Lord Jesus Christ. And we too are blessed to have such a loving and such a sacrificing shepherd who loves us. Well, verse 2, I think, is the next day. And the shepherd boy is already gone. He's probably run away to hide somewhere after consummating his relationship with his betrothed because he doesn't want Solomon to catch him now, because now he's the only one who can cause a divorce. And of course, he doesn't want to do that. But still, it's not wise to let Solomon get his hands on him. And it's the next day, and it seems that the country girl shares a dream she had the night before with the court ladies. She says, I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. So she says, I sleep, but my heart is awake. Now that's a beautiful picture, I think, of having a dream. Because when you're dreaming, what happens? Well, you are sleeping, your body is asleep, and yet your heart, your inner being, your consciousness is awake. And it's thinking. It's imagining things even while your body sleeps. So I sleep, but my heart is awake. That's a dream. and in her dream she hears the voice of her beloved, knocking at her door, calling for her, "Open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one." And he says, "My head is covered with dew, my locks at the drops of the night, it's raining out here, I'm all wet, let me in." But she's been woken up out of a sound sleep, and she's annoyed. Verse 3, "I've taken off my robe. How can I put it on again? I have washed my feet. How can I defile them?" So she's been woken out of a sound sleep, and she's cranky. I've undressed for bed. I'm only wearing my underrobe. I'd have to get dressed again to come to the door and let him in. And I've washed my feet with her open-toed shoes at the time in the dusty climate. Their feet would get dirty. Well, you didn't want to get your dirty feet in your nice clean bed, so you'd wash your feet before going to bed. And she says, "If I get up to let him in, I'll have to wash my feet all over again." She doesn't feel like doing it. She's annoyed. Verse 4, "My beloved put his hand by the latch of the door, and my heart yearned for him." So at this point, she sees her beloved's hand through the hole in the door. Now understand how their doors worked at the time is that the latch was on the inside. But during the day, when you wanted to invite anyone who wanted to, any of your friends and neighbors to come in, you would hang a cord tied to the latch outside the door. So anyone who came to your door wanted to see you, they could just pull the cord, that would pull the latch, and it would open the door and they could come in. Now at night, when you didn't want to be disturbed, what you would do is you would pull that cord in through a hole in the door to the inside, so that it wasn't hanging outside the door so people couldn't pull it and come in. And that would be saying, "I want privacy, don't come in." But the thing is, think about how insecure that was. Because just anybody could just reach in that hole, grab the cord, pull it out again, and then they could open the door. So we see the complete safety that existed in Israel at the time, that there was absolutely no locks on their doors. Anybody who wanted to could get in. And in Solomon's day, Israel was the safest it ever got. Well, some of my listeners can maybe even remember a time in our country where no one locked their doors. But she sees her beloved's hand through the hole in the door, and suddenly her heart, her emotions wake up. And in Hebrew, it's her bowels. Remember, I've already talked about how they thought of the bowels as the seat of the emotions, because you think of how your stomach clenches up and what happens to your bowels when you get emotional. But her emotions get stirred up when she sees his hand, and her emotions yearn for him. So suddenly she remembers her love. Verse 5, "I arose to open for my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the lock." So she gets up to let him in, and there's myrrh and liquid myrrh all over the lock. Well, you say, what in the world is that? Is this some kind of weird dream thing that she's having? Well, no. See, at the time, people would carry a little bundle of spices around their neck. And if you went to visit somebody and found them not home, what you would do is you would take a little of that spice and you would rub it on their door handle. And that became your olfactory calling card. People would come to the door and they'd smell it and they would say, "Hey, I know that smell. That's so-and-so's smell. That means they came to visit." Well, that was your calling card. So he has left his calling card, and that means he's given up. He's figured she's not going to let him in, so he leaves his scent on the lock in order to turn around and go away. Verse 6, "I opened for my beloved, but my beloved had turned away and was gone. My heart leaped up when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer." So she throws open the door, but her beloved has gone. He's left already. She says, "My heart," and in Hebrew, this is my soul, "the seat of my emotions leaped when he spoke. I heard his voice, and suddenly I wanted him. But it was too late. I looked for him. I couldn't find him. I called him. He gave me no answer." Suddenly she's desperate for him. She's remembered her love, but he's no longer there. Well, that sounds like a dream, doesn't it? In a dream, if you're afraid something's going to happen, it always happens. You figure, oh, what if my baby's gone? What if she's not in her cradle? And you run to the cradle. Well, is the baby ever there? Well, in a dream, no. In reality, yes. In the dream, probably not. You think something bad is going to happen? It does. Pretty much inevitably in a dream. So he's not there. Verse 7, "The watchmen who went about the city found me. They struck me. They wounded me. The keepers of the walls took my veil away from me." So the dream at this point turns into a nightmare. And the watchmen, instead of like the watchmen that she really ran into in chapter 3 at night, and they were just kind to her and directed her to her beloved, in her nightmare, the watchmen, when they find her, they actually strike her. They attack her and wound her. And the keepers of the walls take her veil away, tear off her veil. And for a young lady at that time, that was a grave insult. That was more or less saying you'd consider her a prostitute to rip off her veil. Now here I think we see an interesting lesson. Because we too have a beloved, our Lord Jesus Christ. And my question for you is your greatest fear that your Lord might come for you? and that when he came, you weren't ready. Your love would have cooled to the place where you weren't ready to receive him when he came. And by the time you remembered your love and realized, wait a minute, this is my Lord. This is the one I'm waiting for. This is the one I love. I can't not be ready to receive him. But by the time you realize that, it's too late. And he is gone. Now, I'm not saying necessarily that that ever would happen. But still, would that be your worst nightmare, like it was this girl's? Well, I think that's a good question. Do we feel the same way about our Lord Jesus Christ, that the very worst thing that could happen is that he could come to us and we wouldn't be ready? Well, let's be ready.
This is an amazing story with a wonderful parallel to the relationship we have with God. We too have a loving shepherd that gave his all for us. We too are betrothed, if you will, to the one who so profoundly loves us. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the desperate plan. On our next program, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Tempter Arrives. Thank you for joining us today. We trust that you are learning that the more we study God's Word, the more we can know God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. We'll say so long for now, but we look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.